Hello, everyone. This is Harry Blaser, and I have the honor of talking to Don M. Huber. And the first thing I'm going to do is ask, Don, could you take a few minutes to talk about who you are?
Well, I've worn two hats much of my 55 or 60-year career. I'm a plant pathologist, retired professor from Purdue University, so I'm emeritus professor at Purdue University. I'm also retired colonel from the U.S. Army in medical intelligence. So that my last assignment before retirement was associate director of Armed Forces Medical Intelligence Center. But I've had both of those roles. Both of them interact through human health, as well as that the crops and soils and animal health that supports our human health. Raised on a farm, have a number of degrees, qualifications, preparation for those very enlightening and challenging assignments that I've been privileged to have throughout my career.
You were associated with the infamous Fort Detrick, weren't you, for quite a while?
Yes. We had a lot of defensive research and activities involved there, and we knew that many of our potential adversaries were looking at biological warfare, chemical warfare, and those were areas that we were actively looking at. How do we defend ourselves? How do we protect ourselves and our population and troops from the potential very devastating impact of those products.
And threat to our food supply as well, correct?
Right. Well, it's like Napoleon said, an army still moves on its stomach, and if you want to create total chaos in a society, you have people going hungry. And so biological warfare against crops is a very serious concern. We have enough actual native or natural events that keep us on our toes and keep us actively researching to develop new resistant varieties and better controls from any of those natural diseases that occur.
So were you the main expert that Fort Detrick and the government was depending on in terms of looking at the effects of these agents on plants and our food supply?
No, we had some very dedicated, really great people. USDA still has that role, and really highly qualified people. I was just one of the team that was privileged to be involved in the research and those activities.
So along the way, you became interested or introduced, I guess, to GMOs and glyphosate in particular. And when did you become exposed to those things and become interested in it and start doing research associated with it?
Well, I started seeing things happening disease-wise soon after glyphosate was registered in 1974 as an herbicide. And we were seeing the increase in several diseases that I thought I knew or had a pretty good understanding on what the mode of action of those diseases were, their mode of pathogenesis, and the environmental factors that would influence or predispose to those diseases. And when glyphosate was released and commercially available then, we started seeing an increase in these diseases that didn't match the information that we were getting from the companies as far as mode of action and activity. So that it started out as a curiosity factor. Well, if I missed something somewhere along the line, which science is always a growing experience or an expanding experience, then I was curious as to whether I had missed something or whether for these particular diseases that it fit the information that we knew, but just wasn't generally recognized as part of that mode of action. And so the further I got into my research, then the more involved I became and concerned because of the broad spectrum activity of this very simple compound. That's just a glycine amino acid and a phosphonate, a PO3 entity on that. So it's a very small, very simple compound that has some really profound effects on essentially everything that we deal with in the environment, because it's a very strong mineral chelator to immobilize a lot of the essential nutrients that are needed for plant growth and human health and function. But it's also a very powerful antibiotic against many of the beneficial organisms in the soil and also in our GI tract. They're all very susceptible to this antibiotic, but the pathogens are quite resistant, so that we get a dysbiosis in our GI tract, in other words, a change in the balance of organisms in favor of the pathogens, the disease organisms, and the same thing happens in the soil, so that our plant pathogens are increased in their virulence and their overall activity and survival. Many of the normal organisms that would control or suppress those pathogens in nature are sensitive to glyphosate, so that they are eliminated or suppressed. And so we see a combination of factors that are involved here, favoring the pathogen, but then also shutting down the resistance mechanisms of the plant to make them much more susceptible. And the same thing with us as humans, or as our animals, also becoming much more susceptible because our immune system is compromised in that. And then you add the GMO component, which 85% of our plants are engineered to tolerate or to accumulate this herbicide, antibiotic, and you see a system then that is designed essentially for failure from a health and nutrition standpoint.
So let me ask this question. You said that the industry basically put out there what the mechanism was for how glyphosate worked. And then you did your own research and found out, gee, it wasn't quite what they claimed. So what did they claim was the mechanism?
Well, they claimed that it only inhibited one enzyme, a very specific enzyme that mammals are the only living thing that don't have that particular enzyme in their cells. That's the EPSPS enzyme in the shikimate pathway. However, our beneficial gut microorganisms and many of those natural disease suppressive organisms in the soil are all highly dependent on that enzyme and on that pathway for their own survival. In fact, that's how we get our aromatic amino acids, the tryptophan and lysine and tyrosine are all produced by those organisms in our GI tract that are very susceptible to this antibiotic glyphosate.
So it doesn't affect mammals. It just affects the bacteria, of which we're made up 90% of, right?
Yeah, there are 10 times more bacterial cells in our GI tract than there are cells in our body. And if it wasn't for those organisms, we'd be in really tough shape. In fact, when you see the shift from the antibiotic activity on the beneficials and the favoring of the pathogens like E. coli or Salmonella or Listeria or Clostridium, any of those organisms, then you see the tremendous impact that has on our health and well-being. You see the same thing with the suppression of Pseudomonas and Bacillus and the many other beneficial organisms in the soil impacting the health of plants. So it's a total environmental impact type situation that's involved here, not just a specific enzyme that mammals don't contain that is inhibited or limited in this process.
So you did a very brief introduction of yourself, but I guess it's important for people to understand, and correct me if I'm saying anything wrong, that Purdue is one of the foremost agricultural research facilities in the world, correct?
Very active research program, yes.
And you weren't just some ordinary guy. I mean, you had a 50-year career. You had an opportunity to see from two perspectives, the academic world and the field world, the USDA world, and also the military world, studying pathogens and beneficials, you might say, from those two contexts for many, many years. And actually, many people refer to you as one of the foremost experts in this area. Isn't that correct?
No, I didn't quite follow that, Harry. Could you?
Well, what I'm saying is you're just not an ordinary professor. People regard you as one of the foremost experts in the world on these subjects. Isn't that true?
Yes, I'm 55 years or 60 years of research. I'm still very active in a lot of these areas. Still trying to satisfy my curiosity in those lines. I have some areas of expertise that I primarily through hard work and research and study. Guess I don't know how to categorize myself as an expert, except one who's familiar with the ins and outs of some of these diseases. I don't know whether that answers the question. I didn't catch it clearly there.
Well, you're being very modest, and the reason I'm raising this point is for the following reason. You were incredibly well-respected. You were relied on by both military, the USDA, industry, and so on to provide very insightful information and doing great because of your great research and knowledge and experience. And then suddenly, especially since you retired, certain people think that you took a stupid pill and you took a fraud pill. And what I'm getting at is suddenly when you started to become more vocal about the dangers of glyphosate, the dangers of GMO, in particular, the dangers of Roundup Ready alfalfa that got approved because you took a position against that. You advised the Secretary of Agriculture that he should not move ahead for also other reasons, which I want to get into. But then all of a sudden, the gates of hell opened up, and even your own members of your faculty and other agents out there started to attack you as a quack. Is right?
Well, you have to follow the dollars. And I wrote that letter to Secretary Vilsack because I was also chairman of the USDA National Plant Disease Recovery Program, a co-chairman in that capacity. And one of our responsibilities was to alert the secretary and others of emerging diseases that could threaten the viability of our agricultural production. And so I felt an obligation to, when I was seeing some of these things happen, to alert the secretary. And the purpose of the letter was to request the release of USDA people to be able to publish their research on this area, which they had been muzzled and prohibited from talking about, and also to point out some of the new things that were being observed, that an ASCFAR specific research to be conducted in those areas. It was that request then, when that very confidential private letter was leaked to the public, that got everybody concerned because of the dollars that were involved and the concerns that were raised relative to this new technology that we had and still have very limited evidence as to its safety and overall ramifications for agriculture and human health. And that letter to Secretary Vilsack was a request, let's do the research before we put ourselves in a hole and find that we have some concerns that may be irreversible from an agricultural standpoint. And I think we're seeing a lot of that now. But that request, as you're probably aware, kind of went on deaf ears. Again, I think because of the dollars that were involved and kind of the ideology that was also being promoted.
But in that letter, you were referring to something beyond just the chelation and the other antibiotic aspects of glyphosate, which creates tremendous imbalance in the soils and also in our gut, which is kind of a metaphor of the soil, you might add, you might say, and also the GMO technology itself. You were saying that researchers were finding kind of a new organism that had the potential to wreak incredible havoc in our ecosystem. Isn't that correct?
Correct. We are seeing that. And that was kind of a plea or a request to the secretary to release the scientists so that they could do the research to identify some of these new proteins that are being produced through the genetic engineering process that we have never seen in science before.
And by the way, that was something that was predicted by researchers, and one of the concerns that they had about GMOs that was poo-pooed by the industry and their advocates. So what you're saying is we're starting to see that now.
Right. We know that anytime we disrupt the integrity of the genetic code, there are many changes that take place. Functional relationships are anywhere from 40 to 200 new proteins that are produced that we have no idea what they are because we've never seen them in the scientific base before. They're not natural. We saw that with the genetic engineered production of L-tryptophan as a health aid or as a nutrient supplement for the diet, because tryptophan is one of those aromatic amino acids that we can be very deficient in. It's one of the amino acids that is reduced dramatically by the glyphosate. But in the genetic engineering of the L-tryptophan production by particular bacterium, that there was also a new protein that was produced. It took 12 years to identify it, but it within 2 weeks after release of commercialization of that L-tryptophan, 80 people were dead, and it's estimated now between 5 and 10,000 people are permanently incapacitated as a result of that new protein produced by genetic engineering that we had no way of anticipating at the time because we'd never seen it before. But we see many of those new products that are produced, but they're never tested. We had one that I specifically mentioned to the president or to the secretary in that letter that was associated with abortions and infertility, miscarriage, that I had hoped that he would release or permit several scientists to work on that I knew had the capability and had the equipment that they could do that particular research, and had asked for that the secretary provide them permission because they had been prohibited from working on the genetic engineering proteins. Anyone who might find anything of a negative nature was prohibited from pursuing it. Genetic engineering was supposed to solve all the world's problems. And so they couldn't afford to have anyone pointing out that there might be potential problems from it for fear that it would stifle its development. And consequently, that new entity that was being seen then associated with the high rate of miscarriage and abortions that were occurring in our animals, and also same things happening in our people, that we didn't get the funding that was needed to fully characterize that and identify it.
So you also had a particular concern at the time when alfalfa was being considered Roundup Ready, GM modified alfalfa to be basically allowed to exist, which it has become, because basically that is a primary feed for animals, right? Was that one of your major concerns?
Yes, that's our number four economic crop for agriculture. And if what we saw happen in corn with the genetic engineering increasing the susceptibility to Gauss's wilt, a bacterial disease that now costs us literally millions of dollars a year in lost production and deteriorated quality, we saw that disease go from essentially a non-disease or a very rare disease to one that now you can find anywhere that corn is grown in North America. If that same thing would happen or will happen with the Roundup Ready alfalfa, where the genetic engineering process predisposes the plants to increase susceptibility to a sister bacteria, a sister to the Gauss's wilt organism, then we could very easily lose very valuable resource that we rely on for animal production, and that's alfalfa. We have the organism readily available in the environment. It's a matter of whether we can maintain resistance to it. And one of the things that glyphosate does is reduce the resistance to this particular disease. So a matter of 8 or 10 years that our ability to produce that crop economically could be very seriously impaired.
Just for clarification, when we talk about Roundup Ready, we're talking about basically glyphosate because that's the active ingredient in Roundup, correct?
Right.
Now, one thing I'd like to address with you, if you don't mind, because on the internet, there's a lot of crap about this guy, Kevin Fulta, who supposedly made an offer to do DNA sequencing of these of this organism that you guys were finding and complaining about in your letter to the Secretary of Agriculture, and that they're making a big deal out of the fact that you didn't take up his offer. So do you want to take a minute to talk about what that is all about?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Kevin Fulda, I think New York Times investigative reporters found that he had not only solicited what appeared to be a bribe from the company to discredit anyone who challenged genetic engineering or any of their products. And his approach here was, he said, you give it to me, you do all the work, and then I'll prove and I'll show that you're a fraud. Well, that's not the way that you have cooperation in science. The objective is to find out what the truth is, not to prove that somebody is taking a stand one way or another. And he was asking me to do all the work, as I told him to start with. That wasn't my call. There were other scientists that were involved here and in the research that were working on it to start with. The entity, these proteins, don't necessarily have DNA and RNA in them, so that he would have had the incapability of doing that to start with. But you're just, the approach isn't the kind of cooperation that you want. You want someone who's objective and someone who is a scientist, not someone who is being paid to discredit. To start with, as it would appear from the New York Times article on Mr. Fulda, what his objective was, where he was receiving $25,000 to discredit anyone that challenged genetic engineering. And so it was hardly an honest approach from my standpoint. It was merely a challenge to disrupt, and he, personally, from my comment, my opinion, he had no capability of doing it because of his perceived bias and assumption that just because something's able to grow and multiply, reproduce itself, that it has to have DNA or not RNA. And that's part of the failing of our knowledge of what happens genetically, but certainly a prion doesn't have DNA or RNA, but it self-replicates. A wasting disease, a mad cow disease, Creutzfeldt-Jakob, Carew, all of those diseases don't involve DNA or RNA, but very serious terminal diseases for the entity that those self-replicating proteins develop in. So when Mr. Fulta made that challenge, he had also defamed me in letters to the university beforehand, and that, where I was presenting a workshop on mineral nutrition, and he took the stand that that would discredit the university to even have me as a speaker. on it. He had already pretty much presented his case as being there as to disrupt and to destroy rather than to complement and add additional knowledge and understanding to the process that we have such a limited understanding of. So it was not accepted, not because I had any concern about his doing it, but a concern about his scientific ethics that had already been questioned through his letters and through his statements that he had made to university people and organizers of different meetings, challenging even my ability to speak. So it's just not the type of, it's not scientific. As I understand the scientific principle and have practiced it throughout my 60-year career, and I have no objections to him raising questions or anyone else, but that's not the way you get the answer to the question to receive what appears to be a bribe to discredit rather than an honest scientific approach where you have the credibility to do the research that you're stating you will do. I noticed in one of his Professor Fulda's blogs that he stated he was having to work on a long weekend, a four-day weekend, had to spend it in the office rather than being out on a bike ride or some other activity, because it had a really great paper that had been rejected by three or four scientific journals, and he was trying to get it rewritten so that it might be acceptable by somebody. Well, that's not the kind of credibility that you want for a cooperator in your science. I didn't follow up there. Now, that research is continuing. With that, it's on a bootleg basis more with the dedicated scientists. Tremendous amount of information that is available on it and will be published when the proper ID can be placed on that particular entity. But there are many others that we see, other new proteins that we see as a result of the genetic engineering process that we have no idea what their chronic exposure can do or what health risks are involved there. We've abandoned the precautionary principle. And that just happens to be one of the entities that had been developed long and far enough along that you could see that constant association that said, hey, there's a red flag here that we need to pursue and see whether this is cause or correlation and resolve this issue to at least find out what's causing this very high rate of abortion and infertility that we're experiencing now that we hadn't seen prior to the GMOs.
So while I'm at it, I'm going to address one other attack on you. These are guys from your own university here. Jim Kimberato, who's a soil fertility specialist, Sean Castile, a soybean agronomist at Purdue, Peter Goldsborough, department head for botany and plant pathology, Bill Johnson, extension weed scientist, Purdue University, and Kirsten Wise, extension field crop pathologist, also at Purdue, and Charles Woloshuk. Now, basically, these guys put out an article, and it says, the claims that glyphosate is having a widespread effect on plant health are largely unsubstantiated. To date, there is limited scientific research data that suggests that plant diseases have increased in GM crops due to the use of glyphosate. Most importantly, the impact of these interactions on yield has not been demonstrated. Therefore, we maintain our recommendations of judicious glyphosate use for weed control. We encourage crop producers, agribusiness personnel, and the general public to speak with university extension personnel before making changes in crop production practices that are based on sensationalist claims instead of facts. And of course, those sensationalist claims are coming from you. So what do you think about the fact that these guys right from your university with some pedigree and even the head of the botany department says that you're full of crap?
Well, you have to follow the dollars again. And you also have to consider what their association was with me, their familiarity with my research over that 35-year period, because most of those people, half of them, had no idea what my research was. I don't know why they would sign on to a statement in the public release on that information, because they had no idea what my research had been the previous 35 years, where I had extensive research. My last 20 years was, how do we remediate the damage that's being done? How do we offset the effect? We know that all of the herbicides are mineral chelators. That's how they work. That's how you shut down a physiological pathway, is by chelating or immobilizing that critical micronutrient that is the cofactor for those enzymes. And if you immobilize that, you turn the motor off there and that enzyme function. And so you get into the Pacific Northwest, you get into the Canadian prairies where we use the phenoxyprop type herbicides. Ian Evans, agronomist and for Ag Canada, would tell all of his growers, make sure you get copper out to make a full sufficiency on these low copper soils. You're going to have a very severe ergot disease and very poor crops, because copper deficiency changes the susceptibility to that particular disease. Barney Gordon at Kansas said, if you're going to grow Roundup Ready soybeans, make sure that you have your manganese levels at full sufficiency, and it may take 2.5 to 5 pounds more manganese per acre to meet the sufficiency needs of the Roundup Ready compared to the non-Roundup Ready parent. That research is the same as what I was sharing with my growers in Indiana, was that there is reduced nutrient efficiency, nutrient availability, very well documented in the literature. We used to talk about yield drag with the genetically engineered crops. Once the companies prohibited any of that research being done, then people forgot about the yield drag because they didn't have any way to identify it and compare it. But that's a very common, well-recognized phenomena. And these are young enough people that apparently didn't have access to the older literature, or didn't take the time to search the older literature and to understand what normal used to be compared to what normal today is.
I like to tell the listeners the following. There's a new book out by Carrie Gillum. It's called Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer and the Corruption of Science. This is a very reputable researcher and journalist who spent a lot of time going through documents that had become available through not only Freedom of Information Act, but also lawsuits against Monsanto, where she shows the shenanigans going on. So you have the face of Monsanto, what they say, and then you have the emails and other documentation that shows what they're really thinking and doing, and how they go out of their way to stack the deck, to recruit people like Falter, to create noise, and go after people like Dr. Hubert to destroy their image, their character, and years of research based on great intelligence, great integrity. But then also, when you go to Wikipedia, you can see what it says about Vilsack. Has repeatedly demonstrated a preference for large industrial farms and genetically modified crops. As Iowa State governor, he originated the Seed Preemption Bill in 2005, effectively blocking local communities from regulating where genetically engineered crops would be grown. Additionally, Vilsack was the founder and former chair of the Governor's Biotechnology Partnership and was named Governor of the Year by the Biotechnology Industry Organization. So what I see here, Dr. Huber, and the reason I wanted you is because to me, you are one of my heroes, and you're also somebody that really knows what they're talking about. But not only that, common sense would tell you, if this thing is a chelator, an antibiotic, oh, by the way, Monsanto has patents, you know, for it being these things, among other things. And how could it not disrupt your soil? How could it not disrupt the bacteria in your gut? So common sense tells you, you don't have to be a scientist to understand that, of course, it's going to do that. That's how it operates. So what I see here is that we've got a crime scene. We've got crimes being committed that are ending up in the destruction of our ecology and the destruction of human lives and actually causing death. That's basically being covered up by the government and with the cooperation of industry, cooperation of media. So do you think that's an apt description of what we're seeing here?
Yes, actually, it's when we would evaluate the potential for various agents for as biological warfare agents against us, this approach probably meets all of the vulnerability aspects that we would be concerned about. And yet they're totally ignored by our people who've been entrusted to protect us, and been a total betrayal of that trust that we've placed in them, all for the almighty dollar.
Is that the only reason, you think?
Well, there are a number of speculations out there as to why people might be willing to accept major health epidemic or pandemic. I guess I don't get involved in those. I read them, look at them. I have been involved in a number of cases with the desire for population control. That was probably one of my black marks in certain groups in challenging some of those approaches for mass genocide and that were essentially being proposed on from a governmental standpoint. And that opposition, I am happy to say, I think I had an impact in reducing it and putting it in a different perspective. Or just one of those things that you do because that's the right thing to do when you challenge those. And it's the same thing here.
Are you saying you were in a position at one point to see certain proposals and plans being put forward for mass genocide, for population reduction, and you were a force against that?
Took a very definite stand that's not the role of government or anyone else that violates the genocide treaties, our UN stand, and a number of other things. And I was able to work with people in key places in our government, as well as other governments, to make that point that it was a betrayal of the public trust. I have some very serious concerns that those ideas still flourish in some avenues, but certainly if you just look at it from a straight vulnerability standpoint, agricultural sustainability standpoint, you have to raise the question of why would we essentially do everything that we have plenty of experience with in the past that would jeopardize our agricultural sustainability and defense against both natural as well as offensive agents and expose ourselves to that kind of a problem? In the Cold War, we did everything we could to minimize that genetic vulnerability in our crops. Now we have 98% of our number two crop that is all one genetic base, Roundup Ready, which could have turned during the 1970-71 corn leaf blight epidemic. What happens when you have 70% of your agricultural production with a single genetic characteristic, and that was the Texas male sterile? Our advantage there was that we had a lot of, and our ability to recover quickly, maintain our production with that natural mutation, was that we had the ability then with 30% of our commercial crops not being Texas male sterile, and also we had literally hundreds of private seed companies, small seed companies that were able to rally their production and move away from the Texas male sterile to restore resistance then to that particular disease. None of those conditions exist today. Four companies control, or five companies control, essentially all of our major seed supply. None of them, to my knowledge, are really paying a whole lot of attention on making sure that we have that diversity from a genetic standpoint that would buffer against either a natural or a man-made epidemic and its impact then on politics as well as human suffering in that from an agricultural standpoint. But it's not just an army that still moves on its stomach. Society moves on its stomach. And agriculture is the basic infrastructure for any society. And when you destroy your infrastructure, your increase its vulnerability, you essentially have rendered the system extremely vulnerable to severe casualties along the way.
So in addition to everything else that's bad about GMOs and the associated chemicals that are used, in fact, one of the reasons that GMOs were invented was so that you could use those chemicals without destroying the crop, so that as though that's going to be good for us to eat many more of those chemicals. But one of the other major themes you're talking about is the destruction of diversity, which is the foundation for vitality in ecological systems.
Right. And a lot of those systems, it's not like turning on a faucet and reversing them. It's those, many of those are long-term effects that we have to work at to reverse the damage that is done. And you can set up an experiment that gets the results that you want, but it doesn't mean that that's the impact and the full story that should be told and that should be evaluated and analyzed.
So it's clear that there are powerful forces pushing for an agenda that is not good for our soil, good for our world, good for our health. It's not good for people. It's not good for animals. It's not good for bacteria. It's not good for Gaia. What's the way to stop this?
I think that's a correct statement, whether you're looking at it from an overt or just a natural biology. Biology is always changing. Before we could register a pesticide or an herbicide or any of them earlier, we used to have to identify what the degradation process was, what the overall environmental impact. With glyphosate, for some reason, those requirements weren't initiated or weren't maintained on it, and it was given a pass just because of the statement that, well, it only affects one enzyme and it can never be toxic to mammals because mammals don't have that particular enzyme. And so it was given a pass on the safety. But there are many other things, and as we've already discussed, the antibiotics, the fact that it's a synthetic amino acid that is basic to many of our proteins. Probably 50% of our proteins contain glycine. And so if it starts substituting for any of those proteins, whether it's an enzyme or whether it's a structural protein, you change the activity and behavior. And all of those aspects need to be considered when you consider something that's used on 90-plus percent of your agricultural acreage. That was never permitted before. An example would be when, with the herbicide Tordon, we knew that it took 4 years for full degradation. It could only be used on a maximum of 20% of the potential acreage in any 1 year to give it time for breakdown. We rotated those herbicides with our different crops. Now you have one herbicide primarily that is used on 98% of your acreage that has a very broad spectrum impact on the environment, as you've discussed. So there's no relief. We find ourselves in a hole and we just keep digging.
So I just, we'll leave here shortly, but I just wanted to again ask this question. What, in your opinion, what are the most effective ways to reverse these negative, deadly trends?
One of the first things from my research and purpose of my research was in counteracting these effects. How do we use the technology? And at the time, that was a question, well, how do we use the technology without taking a beating? And one of them was to recognize that it reduces nutrient efficiency, nutrient availability, both biologically as well as soil-wise. And we need to recognize that it takes more available nutrient to compensate for and offset some of these effects. Now, that's a short-term response. Long-term, it means we need to build our soil biology back up. Everything starts there. If you have healthy soils, you can have healthy plants, nutritious plants. And this is the year of the soil microbiome. So we need to look at that biology that is the basis for much of our nutrient availability. We need to change what we're doing. We can't keep just dumping this material on at half a billion pounds per year in the U.S., for about half of it for agricultural and half of it for non-agricultural use, and expect a different result from year to year. We have to start using some common sense, some reasoning, and look at other approaches for weed control, for disease control. If we'll get nutrition back so that the plant is competitive, we'll see a very significant move towards that improved health and vigor of our plants and nutritional value. We'll see that reflected in our children and our people. think that future historians will look back, as I've made this statement before, that they'll look back and write about our time, not about how many pounds of pesticides we did or didn't apply, but about how willing we are to sacrifice our children and jeopardize future generations for this massive experiment that we call genetic engineering, that's based on flawed science and failed promises just to benefit the bottom line of a commercial enterprise. And we see that same philosophy being held now. They say, well, now that we have resistant weeds to glyphosate, to the Roundup, we have to add another one. And so we do it with dicamba, a very toxic compound. Dicamba's not enough, so we'll do it with 2,4-D. You look at our legacy from Agent Orange and the birth defects and that from the Vietnam era, and we just keep multiplying the damage rather than stepping back and saying, hey, this got us into some pretty serious problems. Let's take another approach. Let's go back to some of the techniques and some of the approaches that we had were working on in the 1950s and 60s or 1940s that I can still remember as being very effective from a crop production standpoint. Not always easier, but very effective from a production standpoint and a quality standpoint. So hopefully we'll do that. Sometimes we do it only after we've exhausted all other means, but I think our health problems are reaching the magnitude that no society can sustain the damage that we're doing to our children and grandchildren.
So in the meantime, ordinary people can eat organic, they can support local farmers that they can verify are using truly sustainable practices, that are not using GMOs, that are not using these terrible toxic chemicals that are creating huge imbalances, and they can not buy products at their grocery stores that use GMOs, that have GMOs in them. They could not buy meat and so on that are fed GMOs, even farm fish. So would you agree that that's a way that the individual can help turn the tide?
I think that's what will turn it and is turning it. I think if you look at the market share, it's starting to shift now. People are recognizing that what we've been doing here in the recent past isn't working. It's creating tremendous problems. You know, it's a little more expensive now to purchase just the organic sometimes, not necessarily, but sometimes. But you either pay a little bit more for that quality food, or you pay it in a doctor with a lot of heartache and damage that's done on a long-term basis with our children. I fully agree with you that getting that healthy food, that clean food, is critical for the survival and maintenance of our society.
So how old are you now, Doctor?
I'm 82.
I want to thank you so much for taking this time. You are, again, one of my heroes. You have incredible knowledge, incredible experience. You've been on the front lines for many, many decades. You have incredible integrity. And the world owes you a debt for your courage in speaking out on these very, very critical matters. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to do it with us.
Well, thank you, Harry. I appreciate the opportunity to share. If I can be of any help, welcome that opportunity. I think there are some things coming on the horizon that will certainly clarify a lot of the gray areas that the companies try to throw out there for us, to confuse people rather than to enlighten. And I have enough optimism that we're going to get through this, but boy, I see the damage to our children and grandchildren and my great-grandchildren that I have a serious concern for, and hope that we can turn it for their sake in a shorter time rather than a longer one as we come. I appreciate your sharing the word and getting the information out to people that is critical for those to make those changes.
Thank you so much, sir.
So,
thank you so much for your time.
Oh, well, you're welcome. Again, Happy New Year. We got a new start. I hope we can use this time effectively to benefit society as a whole, and certainly to strengthen our families and our communities. And that starts with a healthy population as we go along. So thanks to you, and I appreciate you letting me ramble here a little bit.
Hardly rambling. Thank you so much, sir. Best to you and your family.
Okay, thanks, Harry.
Okay, buddy.
Happy New Year to you.
Same.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.